Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording June 3rd, 2020, we're going to be turning our eye to the Indo-Pacific and talk to our fellow Stephen Nagy about what role middle powers can play in the region. Stephen is a senior associate professor in the Department of Politics and International Studies at the International Christian University, Tokyo. Stephen, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Thanks for having me, David, and good morning from Tokyo.
And good evening from Ottawa. So can you start us off by, I guess, talking a little bit about, as you are sitting there in Tokyo, how you are seeing the neck of the woods that you're living in right now? We get a lot of discussion about it in Ottawa, but it's obviously all quite distant. From being in the region, what are you seeing emerge, and how has that been shaped by the past, for North America, I guess, 3 months of COVID, but longer for you actually in Japan?
Well, I think I'd use three key words: dysfunction, leadership, an opportunity. So let me start with dysfunction. I think that the COVID-19 global pandemic has really revealed the level of dysfunction between the United States and China and their inability to separate their strategic competition and the need for cooperation. And I think that their politicization of the COVID-19 pandemic really, really illustrates that, you know, their relationship is very dysfunctional and moving in a very negative direction. In terms of leadership, I think this is also a really important area to look at the region. And I think that we've seen some leaders in terms of how to deal with the coronavirus, South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand. We've seen leadership in terms of, in particular, Japan pushing forward the so-called free and open Indo-Pacific concept and trying to use a pillar of economy to really integrate the region, but at the same time, bolster the security capabilities of states within the region. Lastly, I think opportunity is a good way to be looking at how we could be moving forward. And the opportunity is really to work with other middle powers within this region to try and deal with that first problem, the dysfunction between the United States and China. And that's to lobby them to move towards a more, you know, a competitive relationship, but a competitive relationship that also includes cooperation.
And in your vantage point, what have you seen a significant shift or an evolution in some of those positions and some of the attitudes since the COVID pandemic? Or is it basically just a continuation of trends that were already underway?
Well, I think that the structural competition between the United States and China has been, that's a long-term issue that we've been dealing with. But the COVID-19 global pandemic has really, I think, accelerated and deepened that competition. And it's created a space where I think China has been able to, you know, push some of its core issues and core strategic objectives. And one of them, of course, is the adoption of a National Security Act for Hong Kong, which basically means the end of the one country, two systems model of reunification. We've seen a much more assertive position of the Chinese in the South China Sea. And this is significant in terms of, really the Chinese creating a Chinese lake that they can dominate within the region. And we've seen increased pressure on Taiwan, a liberal democratic society that's recently had a successful election in January. But also it's a liberal democratic society that has, Chinese society, that successfully dealt with the coronavirus without a draconian lockdown. So what we see is China really pushing hard on these core issues. And I think that they have the potential to spark friction and potentially something worse.
And what about on the other side of that great power relationship from the United States, from your vantage point in the region, what has happened on the American side of that equation?
Well, I think there's really mixed sentiment about the United States, and in particular, President Trump. I think in general, countries within the region have seen the Trump administration's more confrontational stance vis-a-vis China as a net positive, but there's great criticism and concern about the lack of linked tactics and a long-term strategy. Where does the Trump administration see, you know, what is their long-term goal in terms of how they're managing this most crucial of relationships? Do they want regime change? Do they want China to behave by the rules? It's really uncertain from countries within the region. And this is something that I think there's this growing debate in the region is, you know, how to help the United States really have a strategic goal when it comes to their relationship with China. And, you know, what should that goal be? And that's a big challenge in this part of the world. I'd like to add, and I think importantly, that, you know, how the United States has managed the coronavirus outbreak on their homeland has also really, you know, I think, created, you know, and it's dented the confidence that many countries have had in the United States to manage their own issues and be able to manage those issues while contributing to peace and security within this region. And this is going to be a growing challenge going forward, especially if President Trump is reelected, because I think most countries in this region see his reelection as a likely a doubling down on its confrontational stance vis-a-vis China, but it'll be a doubling down on that stance without a long-term strategy or a set of linked tactics.
And if I could just push you a little further on your take on how folks in the region view the United States, I just wonder where, so you have kind of these two competing great power approaches towards the WHO. You've got the criticism, at least that we see in North America, of China for not being forthcoming with them initially regarding COVID. But now, of course, in the United States, you've got a withdrawal. So you have a dynamic where you've got one of the first really, or arguably one of the most significant international crises that for the first time in multiple generations, the United States is just simply completely not present in a leadership capacity. And then at the other time, as we've seen just in this last week, you've got all of the civil unrest and protests, and in some cases violence in the United States. And that's juxtaposed with what has in the past year or so happened in Hong Kong. And not to equate one of those two situations at all, but I just wonder how people appreciate that and whether or not that's undermining the ability of people to think that the United States can play a role in condemning what China has done with respect to Hong Kong specifically.
So I think rather than undermining, you know, what China has done in Hong Kong, I think that it's bolstering the authoritarian regime's confidence and in its own argument that, you know, what it, you know, the recent adoption of the National Security Act to quell protests in Hong Kong. You know, the Trump administration, in particular Trump's recent declaration that, you know, he's declared some organizations as terrorist organizations, and he's, you know, brought in the military to stop the protests. From Beijing's standpoint, you know, this is complete equivalency to what Beijing would like to do in Hong Kong. And in many ways, the Trump administration and his comments have legitimated Beijing's, you know, adoption of this national security law. And this is deeply disconcerting, I think, for many countries within the region, because, you know, we're accustomed to a United States and a White House that, you know, has a principled approach to domestic policy and foreign policy. And, you know, it's often not linked very well, but I think at the macro level, we see a lot more coherence than we're seeing with the Trump administration. And my worries is that this is going to embolden authoritarian regimes, in particular China, to be much more assertive within the region.
Okay. And so with that as kind of some of the context for what's happening, you've been doing quite a lot of research recently at, I guess, what I would just sort of frame as ways that countries that aren't either of those two superpowers can work to deal with the situation there. And the term that you're using for this is neo-middle power diplomacy. So can you just talk a little bit about what that concept means and then specifically get into some of the examples of what that can entail and what roles can be played by countries such as you mentioned, Japan, Australia, but also potentially Canada?
And Canada is an important player there. So I think it's useful to first understand what a traditional middle power definition is. And we usually think of traditional definitions of middle powers as countries such as Canada, Australia, and Scandinavian countries that really have advocated for, you know, human rights, human security. They use their middle power positions to try and, you know, push forward agendas such as banning landmines. So it's soft political issues, soft security issues, but they really are normative in nature. But what I think I'm observing, and this is why I use the term neo-middle power diplomacy, is that what we're seeing is in countries within this region is being much more proactive at trying to contribute to building a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific. And what I mean by rules-based order is that, you know, it focuses on transparency, accountability, a common understanding of the usage of sea lanes of communications, of SLOCs, a common understanding of trade. And what we're seeing is countries like Japan, countries like Australia, and I think there's a huge role for Canada here, is to also play a very proactive role in moving away from, I think, human rights and security are, of course, important issues for any middle power, but not just having these on the agenda, but actually proactively shaping and contributing to buttressing a rules-based order. And I think that's what I'm really arguing and trying to cover in my research related to neo-power diplomacy. And, you know, we see most of this occurring in the South China Sea, but also in the broader Indo-Pacific region, where countries like Japan and Australia are really trying to create a critical mass of countries that can constrain China's behavior and try to create an environment that is stable and sustainable from the security standpoint, but also from the economic standpoint.
So I guess we to take a step back, why can't we just simply leave it to the Americans, assuming that they're still interested in that?
Well, the Trump administration is moved towards a unilateral approach to managing China. And what we've seen since the election of President Trump is that I think in many cases, the critical levers of power that would have been useful in pushing back against China, for example, remaining in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, they've been issued by the Trump administration. We've seen that the Trump administration in some ways increased the U.S. military footprint within the region, but it's not as coordinated as well as it could be with middle powers within the region and countries that really are supportive of a stronger approach to China within the region. And we've also seen, I think, those traditional partnerships such as U.S.-Filipino relations, U.S.-Japan relations, U.S.-South Korean relations move in different directions. I think Japan-U.S. relations are much stronger in the region. Australian-U.S. relations are much stronger within the region. But South Korea, U.S. relations and Philippine-U.S. relations, you know, core parts of the security network within the region are not in the same place as they were 4 or 5 years ago. What we'd expect is the United States to really herd its partners within the region and make them work in a much more synergistic and multilateral manner to, you know, constrain China and to, you know, bolster that rules-based behavior. And we haven't seen that yet.
And so is the behavior that you're describing, I guess, my sense without being at all someone that studies the region in depth, is that a lot of the, at least on the defense side, some of the relationships, even though you had countries that might be sort of natural partners to work together, I guess South Korea and Japan particularly, but to lesser extents, at least in what I'm describing, Australia and Canada would often work very closely with the United States, including in the region, but not necessarily the middle powers working with each other as closely. As they might end up in the same types of exercises or even in some cases operations, but they're doing so more because of the relationship with the U.S. military rather than with each other. I don't know if that's an accurate characterization or not, but is that kind of a shift in focus where you've actually got cooperation between the individual countries below the United States in kind of the Western orbit?
That's right. So there's some really good examples of this. So, for example, Canada has sent out warships to the region since at least 2015, and they engage in, you know, transits through from India into the Malacca Straits, into the South China Sea. They visit Shanghai. They also visit Tokyo to show that they're not necessarily targeted one country or the other. But what we've seen is much closer cooperation between Japan and Canada, and that has been regularized. And I think that's really, really important. Australia and Japan as well have engaged in increased security cooperation within the region. Unfortunately, South Korea and Japan are not in that place for a variety of reasons. But we've also seen other middle powers come into the region. So we've had the United Kingdom come into the region, France come into the region, and even the Germans sent ships to the region. But this has been either bilateral or unilaterally deployed naval resources rather than, you know, multilateral actions. And I think that's the direction that I think middle powers need to go, whether that's under the direction or in cooperation with the United States or not, that's a different argument. But I do think that the multilateralization of middle power activities within the region can bring a critical mass of capabilities and capacities to buttress that rules-based order that I think so many countries are interested in.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
And so give us a couple of examples and specifically about what that could actually look like tangibly. So the cooperation, you know, you hear certainly in Canada from the foreign policy establishment, you get reiterations of the mantra that we want to support the rules-based international order. But on the ground in the region, what type of activity specifically can that entail?
So I think there's a few different areas that we could be thinking about, and there are already pre-existing activities. So let's take a look at North Korea and sanctions enforcement in terms of North Korea. So what we've seen is since 2017 and the last nuclear test by the North Koreans is that Canadians and United Kingdom and France and other countries have rotated their surveillance activities and you know, sanctions enforcements with regards to North Korea in the region. So this is an opportunity for coordination of those surveillance activities amongst middle powers to really increase their ability to enforce sanctions, but create more interoperability of their capabilities so that can be deployed in other parts of the region. I think another example is in the South China Sea with the Freedom of Navigation operations. To date, what we've seen is the United States being the primary country that has engaged in phone ops within the region. And Australia has also been in the region. And I think there's an opportunity for coordinated FNOPs within the region to demonstrate that it's not just the United States that is interested in securing sea lanes of communication, but other countries. Now, of course, Canada couldn't do this by itself, and it couldn't do this by itself because, of course, it just doesn't have the capacity to do this by itself. But, you know, working with Australia, working with the Japanese, working with other middle powers, this is an opportunity to demonstrate that, and they are also very interested in ensuring that sea lanes of communications remain free and open and rules-based. I think there's another important area that this kind of coordinated action or multilateral action amongst middle powers can be useful for pushing back against, I think, what we understand as Chinese assertive behavior within the region. And a couple of the areas is, one is related to the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, and the other one is related to Taiwan. So in terms of the East China Sea and the Senkaku Islands, what we've seen is the Chinese using their merchant fleet as well as naval fleets to engage in something what we call lawfare. So they go into the territories that are Japanese territories around the Senkaku Islands. They collect data points and they bring that back to Beijing. And the idea here is that they're demonstrating that the Japanese don't have administrative control of the Senkaku Islands because they can't control these merchant ships going in and out of the waters of the Senkaku Islands. So they're collecting data to really use this in a court of law to suggest and erode away the Japanese claims. So what I think is an opportunity for middle powers to do is to come in and coordinate their actions and to counter that narrative by going into the waters and asking the Japanese for their permission to create a counter case to demonstrate that the Japanese are indeed have administrative control of these waters. So I think this is it's not so much a security approach to understanding the region, but it's trying to create a legal case to support like-minded countries within the region. The last area I mentioned is Taiwan, and this area, this is perhaps the most explosive or potentially dangerous relationship within the region. But I think it's important, again, for us to continue to use cross-strait navigation amongst middle powers, and I don't encourage this to be done individually, but a group of countries to continue to navigate through the straits to demonstrate that they want to ensure that cross-strait relations remain either in the status quo position or they move in a more positive direction, and to demonstrate that these middle powers, and hopefully with the United States, are not willing for China to push reunification in a way that's not peaceful. So I think these are some areas that coordinated action amongst middle powers can reshape the region and bolster some of the more rules-based behavior within the region, constrain China's more assertive behavior within the region, but also form that, you know, collective body of middle powers that has a more more agency within the region. And I think that's a really important aspect. You know, Canada, Japan, and Australia, and other middle powers, they don't want the region to be shaped by the U.S.-China competition. They want to have agency in that process. And agency in that process means that they have to actually step up to the plate, shoulder the burden, and find opportunities to coordinate and buttress the rules-based system within the region.
And so is that that point about effectively finding your own agency in the region and helping shape the outcomes, is that why you said earlier that you thought that there is an important role for Canada? Or is a beyond that in terms of Canada's specific ability to play a role or specific Canadian interests? I guess so. I'd ask you to expand a little bit on why you think that there is an important role for Canada, because I think at times that's questioned in this country about whether or not, given the size of our armed forces and our other assets, that we can actually make a meaningful contribution in any region of the world, and if so, how we come about choosing where to go. So why do we think that there is an important role that Canada can play?
So that's several questions there. So what is Canada's interest in East Asia, the Indo-Pacific? And first and foremost is economic. We have deep interests in having access to the economies within the region, selling Canadian products within the region. And I think we have deep interest in the region being stable. If the region's not stable, it's going to affect Canada's ability to and its economic opportunities within the region. Second, I think that we have many countries within the region that have shared liberal democratic institutions, whether it's South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and others. I think that it's important that we stand up for those principles, because if those principles and those systems do weaken in this part of the world, of course, it has open questions for the resilience of our system back home. So what is Canada's ability to contribute to the region? Here, I think that we have to make the distinction between capability and capacity. And as you mentioned, Canada doesn't have a huge arms force or naval capabilities or capacities, but it does have capabilities. And capabilities could be intelligence gathering. And what that means is that Canada's role could be supportive. It could be providing some intelligence gathering activities within the region to bolster other countries within the region. So we need to think about what is our capabilities and how they can work synergistically with the existing capacities and capabilities within the region. And from this standpoint, that's a smart approach to engagement. Just sending a ship out is not going to, have the same effectiveness as if we, have a target approach to bolstering, for example, maritime awareness capabilities in the South China Sea or the East China Sea. Here, I think Canada has ample capability to contribute to the region, either bilaterally or in a multilateral setting.
And if folks were to ask you, so again, given the situation where even before COVID, our resources are finite, and then even to this point in the COVID response, Ottawa is just awash in debt, and it's quite possible that there will be financial pressures of various kinds on the armed forces and the diplomatic establishment as we reconcile that. If you were asked to prioritize where you would place additional efforts, where would you say? You suggested several different areas where there's a role for middle powers and Canada could potentially engage. How would you prioritize the different avenues of engagement that could play the type of function that you're describing?
So I think that we have to first identify partners. And I think those partners include Japan, South Korea, Australia, Singapore. And the reason why I use those four or five countries is that I think they're stable, liberal democratic societies. We have shared values. And I think that our diplomatic relations suggest that we can find areas where we can match our capabilities to provide some comparative advantages within the region. So I think partners is the first aspect of that question. Second is, as Canada, what do we prioritize within the region? So in my view, I think that economic stability is crucial for this region's prosperity and sustainability, but also future opportunities for Canada. So that means that we should be interested in securing sea lanes of communication, in particular in the South China Sea. And what that means is that we could lend some of our intelligence gathering capabilities, our maritime awareness capabilities to buttress a rules-based system within the South China Sea. And here, I think that our partners, Australia, Japan, Singapore, and others would be willing to cooperate here because they all have a stake in the South China Seas, in particular after the signing of the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, because many of the economies and countries that are part of that partnership are really found in the South China Sea basin. So I think that is a particular area that Canada can contribute in terms of its capabilities. And I think it links to our broader interest in securing, an economic footprint within the region that's based on, a common understanding of rules.
Stephen, thanks so much for joining us from Tokyo this morning, for you and this evening for us here, and sharing your perspective on the region and what Canada could do going forward. The last question we ask all of our guests is what you're reading on that side of the world.
So I'm reading two books right now. One is by Kishore Mahubani, and he's from Singapore, and the book is called Has China Won? And it's contrasting, I think, the United States and China in terms of its governance, its what it's done for providing for its people. And it suggests many areas for improvement of the United States if it really wants to remain a leader in the global community. So that one is really, really provocative because I think that it tests our notion of the United States as a guiding force of positive influence in the world. The second book that I've been reading is really a fiction. It's called Burn In by Peter Singer and August Cole. And it's a fictional novel about AI in the future. And it talks about how AI is shaping global politics in a fictional scenario 10 years from now. They're both really interesting reads, and they give us something to think about the future, and really give us something to guide us of how we can contribute to maybe having a brighter future.
Well, thanks for that, and thanks again for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed, live from Tokyo.
Thanks very much, David. All right.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. Our guest today was Stephen Nagy. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and to leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at www.cgai.ca/donate. And you can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa. And thanks go out to the producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.